BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
So how are you, my old friend?
I'm good.
From the BBC, this is The Disruptors. Those stories of success and failure from the entrepreneurs and innovators shaking up the world around us. Presented by me, Kamal Ahmed.
And me, Rohan Silva. I'm an entrepreneur.
And I'm not. This one is a biggie. We are speaking now to the founder and chief executive of Netflix, Reed Hastings. Can you believe it?
It's a giant company. Their services are available in 190 countries and they have over 200 million subscribers. But, you know, I think we all probably know a bit less about how Netflix started, which wasn't online as it is now, but it actually was initially a DVD subscription service in the 1990s, posting out DVDs in the mail. And then they made a big shift in 2007 to streaming online. And a lot of what we're going to be talking about in this interview is the challenge of making that kind of shift from one type of business to another. We're also going to be talking about Netflix's unique working culture. Reed Hastings released a book last year called The No Rules Rules, which gives a bit of a clue as to how it all works at Netflix.
Okay, ready?
Should we get stuck in?
Let's go.
There we go. Ready, baby.
Ready.
Good. Jump on in.
Well, look, Reed, we often, one of the things we like to ask entrepreneurs we talk to is, did you have an inkling growing up that you wanted to start businesses?
No, growing up, I was not business oriented beyond having a lemonade stand at the end of our street. And when I was 18, I took a year to work selling vacuum cleaners door to door. And I loved that, just interacting with a wide range of people.
Like many of the entrepreneurs we've spoken to in this series, Reed wasn't from an entrepreneurial family. His mother worked in criminal justice and his father was a lawyer.
Reed studied maths at university and on finishing joined the US Peace Corps, teaching in schools across Southern Africa.
I think you've said before that, you know, that gave you a bunch of confidence maybe, or a way of seeing the world which helped.
Sure. Well, I think what I did was teaching overseas. You know, you have a set of great experiences that you helps you grow up. And in my particular one, I was in a very remote area and I taught high school math for 2.5 years, had incredible students. And, you know, in the mid 80s, of course, there was no mobile phones or any of that. So, you know, I'd write a few letters to my parents and friends, but you really are on your own. And, you know, that definitely taught me a lot of independence and self-reliance. You know, I was sick a lot. You'd have to, like, take care of yourself. But again, I think people can get that through various ways, that feeling of you can survive in the world independently and you're not afraid of much. So that was a really wonderful experience.
I think it's a really interesting question of how much is entrepreneurship just sort of inbuilt versus kind of learned. And I don't know. I mean, I think maybe for me growing up as a kind of brown kid in Yorkshire, feeling like, you know, I had to go it alone at times. But as I say, I think it's probably really hard to sort of disentangle. And with Reed, of course, looking back and saying, well, you know, I did this gap year and taught in Southern Africa, that helped give me that independence. But maybe he was like that already, and that's why he chose to do that. So I think it's endlessly interesting, this question of where it all comes from.
So Reed, what was it that first honed your entrepreneurial skill?
I think I've always been obsessed by ideas, and eventually I had an idea that I had to do. And because it took more than one person to do it for this product, you know, I had to start a company to be able to do that idea. My passion for an idea forced me to learn enough business to do the idea.
Now, that idea that Reed's talking about was a very niche piece of technology used for debugging and eliminating memory leaks from software, and it was called Pure.
And that idea of the niche has come up in previous disruptors. Do you remember, Ro, we interviewed James Dyson in an earlier episode, and he told us his detailed story about wanting a better wheelbarrow, so he invented one with a ball at the front rather than a wheel and called it the ball barrow. So often it seems to be, however niche or small the sort of thinking in a way, the notion of I could do that better is a real driving force. Even in the end, it turns out that maybe you can't do things better.
You know, there's something Richard Branson once said, which is that, you know, a business is simply a way of solving someone else's problem. And I think it's really true. And in a sense, it's a very simple thing. And we can overthink business or over-dramatize it in a sense. But, you know, fundamentally, it's about trying to solve a problem for yourself or someone else.
I often get passionate about ideas. And I remember one 35 years ago, which was a foot mouse. And I realized that every time that you dealt with this, you had to take your hand off the keyboard. And if you could control it with your foot and type away, you could be much more productive. And so I was super excited about the foot mouse and got this Stanford design student to help me. And I was sure this was going to take over the world. And it turns out that A, the floor is a very dirty environment. And so, you know, the thing gets clogged up with the grossest things that you can imagine. And then two, your leg cramps after about half an hour. It's not, you know, designed for that high dexterity the way your hands are. And so this whole dream of transforming, you know, the mouse computer ergonomic interface blew up. And I was equally as confident that will succeed as I was that Netflix would succeed.
You know, let's be clear. Most businesses fail. And in a sense, that's what's so cool about the fact people are willing to start them, because it is so risky. And in order to start a company, you have to really, really believe in this thing you're doing. Sometimes it gets all evidence that it's not going to work. So the thing that makes you start something is probably also going to be the same thing inside you that makes you keep going even when something's not working. Because I think, as Reed puts it, maybe entrepreneurs are quite a specific type of person.
You're the kind of person that jumps out of a plane with no parachute because you just assume a bird is going to come by and you're going to catch it at the right moment and it's going to be okay. And most of the time, your entrepreneurial dreams die and you don't catch the bird and you go splat. Okay. And once in a while, the bird does come by and everyone says, well, how did you time the bird? How did you see it? And the answer is you didn't. You just stupidly and irrationally jumped out of the plane. And then, as it was, a bird did come by. That's why I think there's so much luck involved.
So let's talk about that, about Pure software. Because on first surface reading, you built a company and sold it within 6 years or so. So big success.
Right.
But you in the book and certainly elsewhere, you've talked about the lessons you've learned from Pure, and almost a determination to build Netflix in a different way. Will you just talk to us a bit about Pure and that success, but also perhaps elements that you wanted to do very differently in the future?
So my first company, Pure, I was 30 years old when I launched it, and I didn't really understand. I had never managed anyone. I had never worked in a corporation, really. I'd never had a review. I mean, like, I really didn't know anything about organizations. And because the product was very exciting, we doubled our revenue and doubled our revenue and doubled our revenue and just kept doubling. And I could tell that I was not a very good manager. So I was a good product person, but I really didn't know how to organize things. And I didn't know how to be honest with people. I didn't know how to really get a large number of people to cooperate effectively. And so then I always felt lousy. I woke up every day feeling like I'm a crappy leader and this thing's falling apart. I felt like I was letting down all my colleagues in the company and what I cared about. It even got to a point that I resigned to the board. I said, you got to get someone who can do this better. And they were like, look, you have made mistakes, but you're the right person to do this. And it was a little like going to confession and you sort of get the guilt over, you know, by offering to resign. And then I could deal with it a little better. But I was just over my head. The company kept growing and growing. And I got a little bit better, but not better enough for the next double.
Reed, can you unpick a little bit of, you say made mistakes. Can you just unpick that a bit and just,
sure.
Just tell us something about an actual mistake that you learned from and what that felt like and what it was?
Sure, I'll give you two different dimensions. One was in letting someone go. And now I can sit down with someone and calmly say, I think it's best for Netflix, you know, if we replace you. I'm really sorry about that. I know it's, you know, very hurtful. It's disruptive. You're a great person, but I don't think the performance is where we need it. I hope we can stay allies and, you know, just kind of work through things. But 30 years ago, back at Pure, I would sit down with someone to have to let them go, and I would start crying. And I would, you know, I was so anxious about hurting this person, which, you know, nobody likes doing. But it was such a stressful thing for me that I would make the experience for the person being let go five times worse, because it was all about my feelings, not about theirs. Another one is 5 years, I had five different VP of sales, okay, which is incredibly stressful in turning over that organization because I just hired the wrong person. You know, that created enormous stress in the organization.
Why were you so bad at hiring people, Reed?
I just didn't understand it. Didn't understand how to read the people, didn't understand the different expertises. To me, if you sold shoes, you could sell software. So I was just like grossly simplistic.
Pure wound up in 1997, that very same year, Reed embarked on the project he was going to be best known for.
Tell us about where the idea for Netflix came from.
Well, one of my colleagues from Pure, Mark Randolph, and I were kicking around lots of ideas. You know, Amazon was just starting. This is 1997. And we realized, oh, they're going to be really good at selling everything. But renting, where you go like old Blockbuster, is a different logistics because you got to take the goods back. And then a friend told us about DVD relative to the old big VHS cassettes. And we realized, oh, you could mail DVDs very cheaply. They're very robust. And that we could build an Amazon version of Blockbuster. And we knew that eventually DVD would become, you know, internet delivered, would become streaming. But we didn't know when. But we thought, well, if we build a big business that's internet based, we'll be in a great position to navigate that to streaming.
Is it a slightly apocryphal tale, Reed, that you actually had the idea for Netflix because of a late fee that either you or was it a friend on a video, and it so irritated you, you thought there must be a better way of doing this?
No, that's a true story. So I had this late fee and it was, you know, $40. So I remember it, you know, so strongly because it was all my fault. And, you know, part of it is that intense feeling of self-loathing and irritation from having forgotten, you know, to bring the video cassette back.
You remember what the film was?
Yeah, Apollo 13. You know, it was a good film, but oh, yeah. I don't know if it was worth
that.
$40.
And there were sort of quite radical choices you took with the DVD business. You know, no late fees, you could have a DVD as long as you wanted. Pretty lax policy. If you lost the DVD, you know, you'd get another one. How did you arrive at those kinds of radical choices with the company?
Well, we've always been willing to just be bold and try new things. You're not, you know, when we went public in 2002, we were $50 million in revenue, and Blockbuster was $5 billion, so 100 times larger. So you're not going to beat someone 100 times larger with a straightforward conventional approach. So you got to be radical and try things. And if the things you try are radical and winning, then you've got a shot. You definitely need radical to have a chance against a 100 times larger firm.
It's difficult to imagine that Blockbuster was 100 times larger than Netflix. There's something about not being put off by the way that things have always been done or seem to be done, or where the giants are already occupying, and having a belief that there is a new, better way to do things.
Yeah, I agree. And there's something, as you say, super interesting in the way that small companies, small teams might seem completely outmatched by a giant corporation. But actually, they've got this inbuilt advantage in that the small team can be much more nimble, much more creative, because there's next to no bureaucracy or legacy systems to hold you back. And so it really is possible.
A lot of companies, Reed, struggle to shift from one way of working to another. So you're a logistics business, you're mailing out, collecting DVDs. That's a kind of heavy logistics, kind of distribution organization. The streaming world, very different. And, you know, real risk as well. Those two sides of this business could cannibalize one another. And you end up actually with two teams fighting, because if the streaming service does well, my DVD team is losing revenue. How did you think about it at Netflix?
Well, it can be super hard. Think of Kodak for 100 years was the leader in film processing and in film. And, you know, really they represented memories and the sharing of things. And at first they thought, well, if they did digital cameras, that would be enough. But ultimately, you know, Kodak or sort of how people use that morphed into Instagram. And it's like so totally different in the way people deal with memories and images, you know, than what was their skills. So sometimes the market just shifts so greatly that there's no chance for the company to survive.
Yeah.
The other thing is the longer they've done the original business, the harder it is to switch. And Blockbuster was a well-run firm, and they, you know, just they were the king of video rental. They had gotten really, really good at it with intense competition. And if you get so selected to that, it's very difficult then to pivot. So what hurts you is if you're super excellent at one thing, that, you know, makes it harder to be good at other things.
One of the stories in the book read that really I've not come across before was you going and pitching Blockbuster to buy Netflix. Tell us that story, because I was amazed.
Sure, we were, you know, super early before we went public. Maybe we were $10 million of revenue, okay? And so Blockbuster's $5 billion. We said our odds of succeeding against them are quite low. But how about if we partner where we become Blockbuster.com, you know, sort of their online wing, and they get to do stores. You know, the offer in hindsight was nuts, but it was, you know, buy us and we'll run, you know, we'll own half of it and own, you know, the Blockbuster.com and work with you on it. And they were quite polite and thoughtful about it. But in hindsight, now knowing what I know, it was ridiculous.
Yeah, I think you say that you sort of left thinking, is everyone in the Blockbuster headquarters laughing at us? This?
Yeah, well, they probably were. But back to the tri-radical things, we were always into, what do we have to lose to see if they want to work together with us?
How much would it have cost Blockbusters to do that deal at that stage?
Oh, no, almost nothing, like $50 million. I mean, you know, so.
What's your revenue now and where is Blockbusters now?
Blockbuster is zero, going through full bankruptcy and closure, and ours is around $25 billion.
Okay, so it could have been quite a good deal for them, in hindsight.
In hindsight, you know, picking stocks in hindsight is a lovely game.
I'm keen to talk about, you know, Netflix and, you know, the way you've built this company, learning the lessons from Pure. One of the principles that you've written about, talked about, is to do with talent density, you know, having excellent people. Tell us a bit about how that works in practice, thinking about, you know, paying very generously, no bonuses. The way you go about it, I think it's very different to most organizations.
You know, if you think about a championship sports team, if you want to win the championship, you got to have amazing players in every position on the field. That's why we think about it as talent density and being like a professional sports team. And so in professional sports, they pay their people a lot of money. And it's about performance and it's about teamwork. And that's really what we model ourselves on. And in professional sports, if you say you get a bonus for every, you know, basket you score or shot you score, then people hog the ball, right? They don't cooperate as a team. You really want people focused on the overall team success. So that's why we don't use bonuses. We really just focus on, you know, making a contribution to the total team. Most humans want to be team players, but not that many have the skills to do a blind pass, you know, to anticipate where their teammate's going to be. And that's how you win, is when the effectiveness of teamwork. So like someone in marketing says, hey, we should really let product know about this. Think of any team sport is a lot like how a corporation runs. For me, a perfect quarter would be a quarter in which I've made no decisions. I haven't yet had that, but I keep trying to hold that up as the great goal.
There's no holiday leave policy, no specific rules about expenses, I mean, beyond the guiding principle. These are quite radical, right? Most people listening to this will have a fixed number of days leave a year, holiday leave, and will have pretty strict, probably, expense and travel policies about whether you can travel business class or economy.
Sure. Well, think of the, you know, for the last 300 years, the industrial economy factories have powered global economic growth, moving from agricultural to industrial age. And so factory control paradigms, you know, you clock in at a certain time, you clock out, you're paid by the hour, you get a certain number of paid days off. Those are really important in a factory. But then if you think of the creative ecosystem where you're trying to generate ideas and be innovative, then sometimes you have your best idea in the shower. So it's like the definition of being on the clock, like, really doesn't apply in a creative ecosystem. And so, you know, again, this industrial paradigm has infused how everything works because it was so powerful for us and factories were such a big part of the economy. But now it's really the creative age and it's rethinking that relationship. And it's understanding that going on vacation a lot is actually a very healthy thing for work. It's not time away from work. It's charging up your soul. And, you know, again, sometimes you'll have an idea on vacation or when you come back, it'll be incredible. So really, that's the key insight is you want to stimulate the human spirit and human innovation if you run a creative firm rather than an industrial firm.
This is a big leap, isn't it? A big century leap, I think. 20th century, 21st century. I remember Steve Jobs saying that the real skill set you need for the future is one that brings together science and art. I remember when I, you know, many, many years ago when dinosaurs roamed the earth and I was still at school, you either did science or you did arts. That there was no mix. And the big idea now about creativity and engineering is one of those driving forces that means you do need to have different ways of thinking about what makes a company really sing.
Yeah, and if, you know, one of the things you're being paid to do at work is come up with new ideas and be creative and, you know, work with people creatively. Actually, as Reed does with Netflix, maybe you don't need to be in the office, well, at all, which is relevant to this, you know, COVID era. But and also maybe, you know, the idea of 9 to 5 and being there at specific times matters less and less, because what matters is coming up with a new idea and making it happen. So, you know, there are lots of consequences that are pretty big, really, for the way we've worked for a long time, and that come from thinking, okay, we're not turning up at a factory and putting in a 10-hour shift. Instead, we're about trying to use our minds and being creative. How does that, what does that mean for the places we work and the way we work?
How do you, Reed, think about what some people have called the risk of gigantism, and that success for businesses like yours are predicated on the failure of almost everybody else, that it's all about being so commanding in the market that no other trees can grow? Is that a fair criticism of the Netflix model, is that all others must fail?
No more than in any other business. There is a paradox at the heart of capitalism, which is, you know, we want companies to grow, but not abuse their power. And that's why we have a set of controls around regulations and antitrust. And our journey over the next 10, 20, 30 years is to make capitalism work better and better, where the growth of companies really helps people. And again, it's been that way for the last several hundred years of trying to guide capitalism better and better. And it's a work in progress.
Clearly, many entrepreneurs grappling with the impact of COVID and lockdown. I'm just interested in how you might apply, you know, the principles that you've embedded at Netflix and advise entrepreneurs how best to try and navigate this, you know, incredibly challenging moment.
I mean, COVID is a tragedy of just enormous proportions all around the world. And it affects different people in different ways and different businesses in different ways. I don't think there's a uniform form of advice. Ultimately, how you lead your organization, you've got many challenges. You've got competitors, you've got outside events like COVID. And it's just trying to stay to your core and figure out what works best for each situation.
Sorry,
awesome, you guys. It's great to hang out with you, so to speak. Okay.
Thanks, Reef. Thank you so much.
Bye.
Incredible story, Ro, from Reed Hastings. It just shows that notion of having an idea and then driving it so hard and being so involved and then sort of stepping back and letting it work on its own flywheel. Once you've got it going, you just sit there, hopefully relatively satisfied, and watch it kind of just grow and run.
Yeah, amazing. And that, you know, the way he took those lessons from his first company, Pure, and, you know, for him, the big insight, I think, was I'd built a company in which free thinking and creativity wasn't fostered. And as a result, that company couldn't really transition from one era to another. So Reed thought, right, with my next one, I'm going to make sure I think about that culture right from the start. And if I do that, I'll build an organization that's capable of thinking for itself and making big changes and transitions all by itself. You know, this emphasis on culture, on your team's culture, and the way you work being, you know, absolutely critical is just as applicable if you're trying to build Netflix as if you're doing anything else.
And what's been very nice, Ro, is catching up with you again.
You too, my friend. Well, the Disruptors is presented by me, Rohan Silver.
And me, Kamal Ahmed. The producer is Georgia Catt.
Please do subscribe if you haven't already done so you don't miss an episode. And we'll be back soon.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.